Welcome. Thank you so much. I'll start out by noting it's 9 a.m. on Friday, April 12, 2019. This is Science for Non-Scientists, session 4103. In this conference and world affairs session, we'll use the app and a recorded pen system for getting questions from the audience. So if you want to ask a question on the app, you just select this session, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question on the app. Or you can raise your hand, and we have people around the room who will come and give you a note card and a pen and collect that from you when you're done. If you're a student, make sure to note that. Student questions get preference. And please make your questions brief and to the point. And finally, even if you're using the app on the phone, please make sure to silence it. Alrighty. Well, today we're going to explore the art of explaining scientists to non-scientists. I'm Koi Lamoon. I'm a scientist and enthusiastic science communicator here at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. We're joined by three incredibly talented panelists here, and we're going to have an energizing conversation this morning. I'll start by introducing them, and then we'll get rolling hearing about their perspectives. So, on the end, we have Dr. Michelle Thaler. She's Assistant Director of Science for Communications at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. She's the Big Think Ask an Astronomer expert. So if you haven't found the Big Think videos on YouTube yet, I highly recommend you do. She's providing scientific and understandable answers on questions ranging from when will we find alien life to explaining space toilets. In the middle, we have Tai Tashiro. He is a social scientist and relationship expert, and his newest book is Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. He gave a TEDx talk recently, and I also loved one of his other take-home messages from it, which was, we're at our best when we're at our most enthusiastic. And right next to me here, we have Dr. Seth Shostak. He's a senior astronomer at the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI Institute. He hosts a podcast called Big Picture Science, and I would say in a clear testament to his science communication skill, the Washington Post has said that Big Picture Science provides, quote, a concrete look at topics that could feel inscrutable or dull in other hands. So thank you so much for being here, and thank you to the audience for being here. I'm super excited that we have so much incredible science communication talent in this one room. So now, before we get started, I want a quick applause for those of you who have found yourself challenged to explain a complex science topic. Yeah, most of us in this room. And how about a brief boo if you have had your eyes glaze over while listening to a scientific explanation that got a bit too detailed? Right? Most of us have been on both sides of this equation, and it really speaks to the challenge of science communication. So let's dive into this interesting topic, and we'll start by getting some opening comments from our panelists on the state of climate science, the state of science communication, and its value. And Seth, why don't you get us rolling?
You will not be rolling. How many of you like science? All right. I mean, why are we having this panel? Right? This is like preaching to the choir. Although that's, I think, a bad analogy, actually, but there you go. All right. Well, I'll give you my worthless thoughts on this, and I hope that you'll ask truly penetrating and offensive questions. You know, they ask, how do you communicate science to the public, to non-scientists, should we say? And that really is the public, non-scientists. And in particular, how do you apprise them of when they should be suspicious of something that claims to be science? How do you judge science? To me, it struck me like saying, well, maybe we ought to have a panel on, how, writing for non-writers. Like, we don't have panels like that. I don't know why. Because it's assumed that everybody can write. But you would want, if you had such a panel, you would say, well, we need a certain minimum level of expertise amongst the public, minimum literacy, maybe the ability to look at the compositions critically, right? And decide, well, this is good or this is bad. I mean, if I look at what people are reading at the airport, they didn't get that education. Nobody seems to think it's a crisis in any way. It would also be useful for the populace, I think, to understand certain very basic things about science, the nature of atoms and molecules, how medicine works, how heredity works, the scale and the contents of the universe. I'm biased on that, but I think that's good for your soul, if you have a soul. I would also recommend some physics, although I'm not quite sure that everybody would agree with me, but I think physics is actually pretty good because people seem to have ideas about physics that violate physics. Perhaps even more important is the understanding of some very basic science operation, how science works. How does science decide when something is true? I think for a lot of the public, it's an argument from expertise. In other words, if somebody who has a tweed jacket and a bunch of sheepskin on the wall tells them something, then they tend to believe that. This is the argument from expertise, and that's not a very good one. It's very akin, I think, to the arguments that you hear, and I heard it last night at dinner. The aliens must be visiting because we have pilots who claim they've seen something in the skies that's clearly alien activity. So that's the same argument. These guys are experts. As it turns out, actually, pilots are among the worst possible witnesses for this survey. But that's a different story. We might get into it if you feel differently about this and think you are being visited. And by the way, if you have good proof of that, please come see me after this panel because it's job security for me. Here are a few things that struck me. To be able to understand the difference between science and technology. A lot of people, they look at themselves and that's science, man. Well, it's not science, it's technology. But there's a lot of science connected with that, so maybe if you could, teach them the difference. What's the nature of science proof? I just mentioned that. How does science decide whether something is true or not, right? Like cold fusion sounds good, right? You can have a nuclear reactor in your basement or even in the living room and, generate all the power that the neighborhood needs and, you'd be in control of those guys. Well, that would be interesting, but how does science decide where the cold fusion actually works? A couple of scientists in Utah said it works, right? So, that's something. What is meant by a scientific theory? This is almost semantics. But if something is a theory, for the public, that means, well, it's not been established, right? Okay, well, in a very strict sense, no science is ever fully established, right? I mean, you have Newton's laws and, law of gravitation, right? Things fall. And you say, well, it could be that tomorrow that apple will not fall. It'll just sort of hang in the air, right? Could happen, but, we feel fairly confident it won't. But it's still a theory, so they ought to understand that word. Why is basic research actually even more important than applied research? Some of you may remember the Golden Fleece Awards, all right? And this was given by a guy from Wisconsin, Proxmire, and he would give it to research projects that were funded by the government, like NSF is giving money to some guy over here to study the reproductive habits of freshwater otters. And he says, this is a waste of your tax money. And it was because he didn't see any practical application of that, except perhaps to the walk into the otters. I don't know. He didn't see any practical application, and he assumed that unless it had a practical application, it wasn't worth doing. And I think that history would show you that that's totally wrong. Actually, the stuff that has the greatest effect on our future is the basic research, because that leads to applications, but those are the game changers. All the rest are just points in the game. All right, and science versus exploration. I do SETI, so, we're looking for aliens that are just as clever as the residents of Longmont. Well, that's not science in the sense it can't be, normally science is something that can be falsified. If you say there's something out there called a Higgs boson, Bob, okay, well, you can design an experiment that says, well, actually, there's not. We didn't find it. You predicted it would have this energy or whatever, and it's not there. So that's falsification, and that's a hallmark of most science. Looking for E.T., if you don't find E.T., doesn't mean E.T. isn't there. It just means you didn't find it, right? So that's exploration, and that difference is maybe worth being known by the public, finally, and this was, I would put the baloney kit. This is something that Carl Sagan had, and several others, actually, and just sort of a list of things to ask yourself when you hear a remarkable claim, right? Like, I don't know, carrot juice will cure cancer or something. I never heard that, but, you know, you might hear it. And so how do you know whether this is likely to be true or unlikely to be true? In other words, is it baloney? I was just talking to Mike Reese. Is it Reese or Rice? You know the guys? And he lives in New York, and I said, they closed the Carnegie Deli. Isn't that terrible? He said, people don't like the strong anymore. Okay, but maybe they still like bologna. And they do like bologna. So to have a bologna kit where you could actually have sort of a laundry list of things to ask yourself to decide whether something is true or not. Okay, all this is very easy to say, but that's probably why I said it. But what do you do? How do you do it? Now, Twilight just told you, we have a weekly radio show. We reach a lot of kids. I think on the order of 250,000 people, because it's on broadcast too. But once every 4 episodes, we do something called Skeptic Check, where we investigate pseudoscience, right? Some topic in pseudoscience. I remember some guy where I live in the peninsula in Silicon Valley came in and said, a couple of Georgia guys just found a dead Sasquatch, right? Bigfoot. He was dead, fortunately. But they, you know, and so they put him in a bunch of ice and they were taking him on tour. And so there was going to be an argument for the press, or sorry, presentation for the press in a Palo Alto hotel. So we went there, you know, and we recorded, we talked to these guys. It turns out it was a rubber suit that they had bought in Brooklyn, actually. And we traced it down. Within 24 hours, we find this is a fake. It was just too bad. It would have been more interesting if it really been Bigfoot. But we do that. And so you can like, say, okay, that's attacking pseudoscience. Great. But so what? I mean, 250,000 people listen to it, but I'm sure they're like you. They're the choir. They're the ones that tuned in. They already know that Sasquatch is kind of unlikely. You know, there are things like minimum breeding density and stuff. The other thing is the media. I think I have great faith in the media. And I don't mean, you know, it's fake. I think that there are things that the media can do. And in particular, entertainment media, like movies, right? If there was a movie that started in some small town in Kansas, right, where people don't get vaccinated, and all the kids die, and, you know, that leads to problems, and this, that, and the other, that would probably have a lot more effect than having high school science teachers telling you, you know, get your kids vaccinated. So I think the media is an opportunity. The other thing is to, A, recognize that there's a problem. You know, 10 to 12% of the population don't think we went to the moon. One-third of the population believe that the aliens are not just out there, but they're here, buzzing the countryside, one-third. Okay, but one-third of the public also believes in, that's not, by the way, just in the United States, it's all around the world. One-third of the population believes in angels, one-third of the population believes in ghosts. Hey, you know, if you've got good evidence, that's something. 40% don't believe in evolution. Okay, these are well-known problems. My recommendation is to do what they did in the late 50s, when Sputnik was launched. The government got really upset. And said, you know, we've got a big gap here. We're not teaching our kids science. So they put a lot of money into it. And the consequence of that was the PSHC physics courses. You know, there was a big push to teach science at the high school level. And also to fund people at the college and graduate school level. I went to graduate school thanks to that, actually, for free. And I think a program like that, yes, it costs a lot of money, and all these things cost money. But this might be effective. This might give you a lot of bang for buck. So I'd recommend that. Okay.
Thanks, Seth. I think that you brought up more conversation bits than we might even hit in the whole hour. We have 2 more people to hear from too. So, Ty, go ahead and give us a sense of your take on science communication, state of affairs, and value.
Sure. So it's hard to follow Seth, certainly, but I'll give you my perspective from the social science perspective and some of the unique challenges we have and some of the challenges you have, too, when you write about a topic that everyone is interested in, naturally, it actually creates a new set of challenges that you have to overcome. Interestingly, my advisor in graduate school won the Golden Fleece Award back in the 1960s, and it was because she was one of the first 2 people to apply the scientific method to the study of romantic love. Now, this was incredibly threatening, predominantly actually to a lot of males. And there was this outcry that this was immoral and not sacred and violated the natural order and all these other hollow arguments you might hear. So she got pulled before a committee and had to defend why you would do this. Now, why would you study romantic love? And she really instilled this in us, and it gets to Seth's point about basic science. any importance. She said, in a much more articulate way than we say here, that we study romantic relationships because romantic love is the magnifying glass for the mind. She said, in what other kind of relationship do you feel such strong positive emotion? Yeah, when do you feel butterflies and pounding heart and you're sweating and all the other embarrassing things that happen when you're Twitter painted for somebody? What other situation do you feel that sinking in your gut when someone hasn't texted you back or has broken up with you or whatever else it might be? In no other context do you feel such powerful emotions for the most part. She said the reason we study romantic love is because it's a magnifying glass for emotion. It's a magnifying glass for cognition. How often do you ruminate about something as much as you ruminate about unrequited love or a crush? I can't think of many things. How often do you go to such great lengths behaviorally to try to win over a romantic partner? And the creepy thing we did my day was ride your bike by the girl's house. And they get busted sometimes, and I try to ride faster, in the neighborhood. There's now online ways to do that, I'm told, by the Gen Zers. But in one of the circumstances, your behavior so magnified. And I always loved that explanation. And she always drilled into us that the reason you're here in Minnesota to study interpersonal relationships is because they're of value and one of the strongest contributors to our general well-being, but most importantly, you're here to be a great psychologist. You're here to understand behavioral genetics and neuroscience and behaviorism and emotion and cognition in a way that you can then make contributions to those fields and hopefully contribute broader knowledge to the general public. Ellen always saw the study of romantic relationships as, it was amazing by the way, as she's getting called before Congress and ridiculed by some of the pastors of the day who were on television and so forth. She was getting bucketfuls of mail every day. Two bucketfuls of mail from people around the country who said, I have this problem, can you please help me? What she realized, and what I've tried to emulate, I guess, in my career, is that what a gift this was to be able to study something like romantic love, or later on social awkwardness for me, something people had naturally interested in. I saw it as a responsibility to disseminate scientific thinking. Not just to be sensational about the topic itself, but to get people to think about, when you have correlational data, what can you not tell? What can you not infer? Can you tell the direction of the effects? Can you rule out third variables or third possibilities? I think that the scientific underpinnings and that way of thinking is one of the things that can really be a salve in some ways for some of the societal ills that we're suffering right now. I'll go ahead and end my comments there, but I think that I have to say that the early folks who got me started on this and really got me thinking about science communication were my students at the University of Maryland. I was teaching a course on the science of romantic relationships. And I had all these esoteric theories and these sophisticated statistical models. Psychologists will bore you to death. They'll find a way to take an interesting topic and bore you to death with it. And when we had questions, their questions were not about the statistics. Their questions were about, I have a crush on this girl. I have no idea how to speak to her for the first time. And I thought, well, that's a practical question. And I thought to myself, there's tons of psychological science that would help me direct this young man towards a well-formulated solution. And oftentimes, I would ride the metro home thinking I was so disappointed in myself for having so much difficulty translating some of those basic science findings into an application that would actually be useful. So I'm excited to be on this panel, excited to talk more about this topic with the other panelists.
I'll stand up because I'm a little shorter. I can't see everybody's face in the back. It's always a sign that they can't see you. So, good morning, everybody. I think this is kind of a fun progression because I think what I'm going to do is combine a little bit from the last two speakers. So I started out my career as a professional astrophysicist. I was a postdoc at Caltech. I was doing research on a space telescope. And at the time, NASA decided that they'd better get their act in here and actually do communication. And so they really didn't know how to start except to required funding for it. Basically, every mission had to provide 1% of its funding earmarked to something called education and public outreach, and it wasn't defined much more than that. do some outreach to the public. And I was working on the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is about $1 billion mission. So, I mean, 1% of that is, you know, I was getting about $1 million a year. They didn't know what to do with it, so they gave it to a postdoc. And they're like, here, you, come up with a communication program. And, you know, I quickly realized that doing this right was a full-time job. And so, you know, although I did a little bit of scientific research after that, I've been doing full-time science communication strategy policy at the NASA headquarters level for probably about the last 15 years. And things have really changed a lot. I mean, we were talking about, we were just sort of chatting before the panel, that one of the things we have to do is really work with scientists and sort of their natural egos, that they may be, they always think they're the best people to explain this to the public. And at first, we did a lot of kind of understandable missteps. I mean, we'd have enthusiastic scientists come in and say, my work is so amazing. This is true. One of the things we did is we did an activity called helioseismology for fourth graders. Yeah, so helioseismology, the sun actually has compression waves that go all around its surface. You can determine all kinds of cool things, the interior of the sun, solar activity. But, you know, even the word helioseismology, you know, the idea that anybody thought a fourth grader was really ready for that is kind of amazing. So around about 5-10 years ago, we decided to take the money away from the scientists and we'll collaborate with people that know what they're doing. And so, I mean, now we basically have large grants that go to WGBH, does our outreach to teachers. We work with the Girl Scouts. We work with the National Public Libraries. I mean, there are all these people that get our education money to do it better than we do. But diverging from that a little bit, I mean, there are so many aspects of science communication. I'm going to talk about a very specific one. Being a scientist, the reason I'm a scientist is I fell in love with the facts and then the beauty and the stories that are available through science. And one of the things that has been really hard for me to step back from is when you're doing large format public education. You know, I'm on the morning news a lot. When somebody says, hey, there's a new discovery, here's somebody from NASA to tell you about it, and a little head pops up in a box. That's often me. It's called live shock. I was basically slammed on Wednesday. I didn't even come into the conference because of the black hole result, right? I was just doing lots and lots of social media interviews and all of that. And, I mean, so take that as an example. I'm really geeked out about what that image shows you. I can actually draw the world lines from Einstein. I can show you why that black bit is larger than the event horizon. It's really cool why. But people don't remember that, right? What the public remembers is that on Wednesday, people got very excited. They got very enthusiastic. You saw scientists jumping up and down and going, look at this, it's a dark blob, yay, yay. And, you know, it turns out that when we're working with psychologists and psychiatrists at NASA, that's what we realize, is that people really don't come away remembering specific facts. They remember that someone got excited. They remember that something good happened. And it goes back to the fact that, you know, you and I are all primates, right? You know, we have primate behaviors. And when a fellow primate is over there screaming in pain, you want to know what's going on. And when a fellow primate is jumping up and down and cheering, you want to know what's going on, right? And our brains are really attracted to those things. And this has been, you know, a real soul-searching thing for scientists, because we think the most important thing about the science are the facts. But, you know, I mean, I'll do these television shows. I host 2 television shows for the Discovery Science Channel, and people will email me, I love that show. And then they'll ask me a question, which demonstrates to me that they didn't understand a single thing I said. And, you know, so, but isn't it bad? I mean, what they found was inspiration. They felt a connection to the universe. They felt that science was something good, and that they could be included in it. And at that level of large public stuff, I mean, I'm okay with that. And then the problem is getting scientists to buy into this. And we actually work with a university program. It's the Alan Alda Center for Science Communication. I think a lot of you remember the actor Alan Alda, who's Hawkeye Pierce most famously. But Alan Alda also had a show called Scientific American Frontiers in the 1980s. And he would go around and interview scientists and go to their labs. And what he said happened was before the cameras were rolling, a scientist would be showing them the laboratory, and they'd be excited. This is really cool. Look what we found. We did this. And then the cameras would start to roll. And in Alan Alda's words, he watched the scientists turn gray. You know, we're supposed to be logical and emotionless, and that makes us a better scientist somehow. And it was really a barrier for the public actually appreciating and understanding what we were doing. So at NASA, we bring in improv actors. We bring in stand-up comedians. We do mirroring exercises. The scientists hate this. I actually have to kind of talk them down and say, trust me. Okay, at the end of the 3-day training that I'm going to give you, you will understand why we had you do this. And at the end, to a person, they've all really improved their science education. The idea that it's not about conveying facts, or at most, you're going to convey one or two facts. If you're giving an hour-long public lecture, think of one or two things you want them to remember. Three is a stretch. Seriously, I mean, we've done the research as to what people actually come away with. And if they come away with this, you know, I mean, I did a talk last time I was here at the Fisk Planetarium on Saturn, and we mainly just looked at how beautiful the images were. You know, if you want more information about exactly what's going on, I can tell you. But start with the beauty and the connection. Another thing we do is we often work with congressional representatives who come and they want to learn about your science. And you may have them only for 15 minutes. You know, can you show them one image? Instead of a whole PowerPoint presentation they're never going to remember. You know, can we just give you one thing? And can I tell you why this is evocative to me? You know, I'm going to show you how the lights of Puerto Rico, different, you know, post and pre-Hurricane Maria, from our satellites, we watched the destruction in Puerto Rico. Don't give me a PowerPoint. Give me a single image and talk to me. Give me a narrative. Tell me why this is important. So we make our scientists explain their science in 5 minutes, then we give them 2 minutes, then we give them 1 minute, then we give them 30 seconds. And a lot of people think that the 30 seconds one is the better. We do exercises after exercises, trying to break it into a narrative so that you can understand. So, you know, we are deliberately trying to break down the barriers between us and our audience. Because thinking that science is something that only a few people do and you have no idea why they do it, then that's the end of science if that happens. So, thank you.
You'll see, just a quick reminder to the audience, you can lift up your hand for a card, or you can send a question up on the app. One thing that came across here was that, each of you have kind of found yourself talking about topics that were a bit surprising or stunning to people at different points in time. And I'm wondering if you... Some areas of science are certainly more political than others, and maybe, Michelle, you can speak to this first. Do you approach science communication in a strongly political topic different than another topic?
Well, so I think certainly the implication here, and we do a lot of this, is we do a lot of outreach about things like climate change, for example. And you know, one of the things that we figured out, probably not as quickly as we should have done, is that bringing more and more facts to the table doesn't help. You know, somebody would say, you know, it's not 100% scientific consensus. You know, sure, 97 scientists say yes, but 3 say no. It turns out even that was misleading. There really is not a single seriously practicing scientist that doesn't think that climate change is happening. There's plenty of debate about exactly what the most important contributors are. You know, for example, deforestation actually is a bigger contributor to climate change than all of our transportation emissions. But we don't really talk about it that much. There's scientific controversy as to how quickly the ice caps will melt and how quickly the ocean level will rise. But the idea that there's something happening, the scientific consensus is 100%. I mean, really, there's no actual correctly practicing scientist that believes something is not happening. And I think it surprised us that when we went to the government, when we went to the public, you know, people who are climate deniers, it's like, okay, well, at first we had 5 years of data about how quickly the Greenland ice cap is melting. Now we have 10 years of data. Now we have 15 years of data. The trend is really clear. It's really consistent. And it doesn't seem to change their opinion. So, we brought in psychiatrists. We brought in psychologists and children's book authors. And we said, how do you talk to people where, they have an invested emotional investment in the belief. You know, they really don't want to give it up because that would prove them wrong somehow, and that would be a difficult thing for them to do. So we learned to do a lot of listening. You know, don't just sit there and talk at them. You know, ask them, you know, how did you come to feel that this was a hoax, or how did you come to feel that this was not happening? Is there any specific question I can answer for you? The other thing we found out is that for a lot of this, we couldn't budge them. I mean, there's a subset of the population. I mean, I was asked to debate the head of the Flat Earth Society on the Discovery Channel, and I said, absolutely not. There's nothing to debate. You know, I mean, he would say the Earth is flat, I'd say it's not, and where do we go from there, right? I mean, it's just, one is right, and one is not. And so, you know, for very politicized things, I mean, one of the things I'm very proud of at NASA is we're never asked to lie or misrepresent the scientific truth. So as a federal scientist, and I think this is appropriate, I can't tell you what policy you should adopt. You know, carbon dioxide emissions are going up, therefore have no more coal plants. But that's not for me to say. That's for the Congress and the American public to say. But they have never asked us to say climate change isn't happening and that it isn't human-driven, because these things are just so well-known. So, you know, we are still struggling with this. We were trying to get people to back away from more facts means you will convince people. We're trying to get people to go more into the narrative, the emotion. You know, if someone says, you know, your scientists have a conspiracy to hide something for us, it's like, well, that would be me. You know, I'm who you're talking to. You're saying I'm lying to you. That's not okay. You know, we're trying to get down to the personal level, and maybe that will help a little bit.
Tyler, Seth, I imagine both of you have also spent some time occasionally touching topics that are a bit more political or controversial.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's a bit controversial is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5. One of the areas that's controversial about it is the section called paraphilia, which is the what they call sexual disorders. And it's a section that's fraught with bad science, actually. Most of the paraphilia, one of the criteria is that they're unusual. Most paraphilias are actually quite common. You know, they're more common than they are not. And so that doesn't meet that criteria for all the ones they've included, almost all of them. One of the ones that's, I think, interesting politically, that's very inconvenient for heterosexual men, is a disorder called female sexual arousal disorder, which means that the woman's, you know, basically not enjoying sex and physiologically isn't having certain reactions as you might want to. Now, there's no disorder called male performance disorder. You know, and that is more of the causal thing. If you look at data on orgasm and with heterosexual couples, and you ask after the last time you had sex, did you orgasm? The woman will say about 66% of the time they say yes. Men, they were there. They were, you know, taking part in this very intimately. 95% of the time, like, oh, yes, you did. You know? So you have this huge discrepancy between what's actually happening and what the man thinks. But that same discrepancy then is reflected in the DSM and the fact that you have all men sitting on these committees deciding whether something is a disorder or not. And so how you talk about that and you try to change the narrative about that is very difficult. And it's weird that for something that's empirically driven, there's so many other sections, that in certain places the science is totally absent.
What I do isn't terribly political. Although there is a, by the way, as far as climate science goes, are combating a lot of this. I mean, I think it's pretty well established that what you have to do is indeed not present counter facts. Hey, no, look at the CO2 levels going up here. Have another bubbly water there. I mean, that's not it. The thing to do is to co-opt things they already believe in and see how it affects them directly. So now you're a little more resonant with what they consider important for themselves. I suspect that, you know, as soon as certain golf courses begin to go underwater, then you may see a change in the attitudes. So because it's something that he's, you know, he's interested in. In my field, the only politics are, to begin with NASA, with Michelle sitting here, I sort of hesitate to say this, but NASA has an astrobiology program. It's a fairly large program. It's a very good program, actually. But they're looking for life in space. But, you know, pond scum under the surface of Mars, or maybe on Europa.
Or pond scum. Give me pond scum. Give me pond scum.
But they won't look for intelligent life. There's some other worlds in the solar system where there might be life, right? But that would all be life you'd need a microscope to see, which is pretty good, but it won't hold up its side of the conversation. If you want to find the aliens that do, then you have to do a different kind of an experiment. And NASA used to do that. They don't do it, and they haven't done it since 1993. And the reason is they're chary of it. They're afraid of it. They think that they will be ridiculed. NASA's I think, somewhat ossified, right? Because they, that happens with any organization that's 60 or 70 years old, that you know you get burned on some issue, so you put in place things to prevent that from happening again. And the result, finally, is an edifice in which you're so defensive that you're not willing to take too many chances. I say this in the end of...
Well, I hope so. It's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
I think you're largely correct.
Yeah. Okay. But for us, I mean, the only politics is, you know, is the government covering up evidence of visitation. And as I say, one-third of the public thinks, yes, they are. I've worked for the government. I never thought they were very good at covering anything up. Honestly, not. I mean, you know, in Nia Dill, they covered up for 2 weeks. All right. So I just don't buy that. But the public does think that. And when that said to me, you're just a mouthpiece for NASA. And that's some talk. And I said, well, if that's true, they owe me back pay.
So it's a variety of these different topics that come up, we have a good laugh at people who think the Earth is flat or people who think that they had an alien come over for dinner. And, right. These are, of course, topics that get spoken to, and some kind of anti-science ideas are developed in very sophisticated ways. And you spoke to some of the move towards talking with emotion in science communication. I'm wondering, do you think there are certain strategies that we need to use more in science communication to, I love as this question said, conspiracy is sexy, facts are boring. You know, are there ways that we're sexing up science communication to help be the lead headline?
I'm a big fan, and I think this is underused sometimes, storytelling. There are always interesting stories to illuminate the science, and those are the things people are interested in. One of my heroes in, I guess it would be math statistical communication, is Michael Lewis. He takes things like subprime mortgage packages and makes them very, very interesting in Dronville. And how does he do that? Well, he found the characters who were involved in that, who were really captivating and interesting, and he developed those characters and developed the situation and circumstances. And one of the things when I started doing science communication that I realized was that my training as a scientist, or to write scientifically, had no scene, character, or plot. And when I read the literature books about how you write great literature, you need to develop great scene, character, and plot. And it's something that we can all do. We're all great storytellers, right? We all have that within us. But there is this hesitation sometimes to say that I can cross this line for my scientific self and go to communicate in a way that's more narrative and more emotional.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This is actually a real challenge for me because, the reality is, in fact, so much more interesting than these conspiracy theories. I mean, sort of as Seth was alluding to, the people have the idea that the government can be this unilateral. People are trying to see me, so I'll stand up again. I'm a little short. The idea that the government is this monolithic thing that could have a huge conspiracy. You know, the idea that we didn't go to the moon. You know, over decades, there were 500,000 people that worked on the Apollo project, and how you could possibly get every single one of them to be silent when at the same time they say the government is incompetent and disorganized and can't do anything. And it's a really interesting contradiction. Reality is so much more interesting than anything these people are coming up with, right? Okay, so on Wednesday, we saw a dark spot where light was being absorbed by an object that had 6 billion times the mass of the sun. And we were looking at an area in the universe where time stops. And, you know, you want to tell me, you know, hiding an alien body? You know, it's nowhere near as interesting as what's actually going on. You know, I mean, a lot of times when I do public talks and I show people pictures of Saturn, I have to make them stop. This is not an artist's illustration. This is not computer generated. This is real. We had a spacecraft orbiting Saturn for 13 years. These amazingly beautiful things are actual images. You know, I mean, reality is so much more interesting. And so getting to the sexiness, you know, I think scientists are really okay to point this out to you. I've had friendly conversations with people that are conspiracy buffs, and I start talking about quantum entanglement, about the non-existence of space and time, about the possibility of a holographic universe. These are all the things of theoretical physics that are being worked on now. They're still conjectural. I mean, they're not proven. But they kind of stop and go, wow, you know, I thought you guys had no imagination at all. And so, you know, I mean, it's one of the reasons why, you know, the shows that I'm on, I largely apologize for, because they have us in these quick cuts where they keep us to seriously 25 seconds, and then they go into something else, and then there's a new illustration, and they're chopped up, and I don't think that's the way to teach science at all. But they're trying to make it sexy, right? They're trying to make it, oh, yeah, you know, now we're looking at the accretion disk of a black hole. And it's over-dramatic, but the science is largely correct. I mean, it wouldn't be on a show that had lots of bad science. Sometimes it's not quite right, but, you know, I think it's up to us, because it is so much sexier than anything they've come up with. I love the fact that I walk around shopping malls and Disneyland, and I see people with NASA t-shirts on. I mean, NASA has some sexiness to it. It has some interesting cred. I mean, you don't see people with Health and Human Services. You know? Right. I mean, NASA is a large organization, and I think, you know, I think honestly one of the reasons we're not probably going to be going back to the moon anytime soon is all these different regulations and layers of red tape and layers of bureaucracy. But at the core of it, I mean, sort of underneath all of that, and I spent years at NASA headquarters where my job was to deal just with that. You know, the science that's happening at NASA is still bleeding edge, amazing stuff. And I'm going to be so excited if you find Martian ponds come. Because you're going to be able to compare the genetics, you're going to be able to compare a completely different origin of life. We do this all the time. I mean, Seth and I have done this for decades. But, you know, I mean, I think there really is value in finding microscopic life, and I think it's right there in our neighborhood. We just need to find the damn stuff. So, yeah, we'll keep it sexy.
Now a word from the scum. Listen, you know, we've been advised to make sure that every question is answered by every panel maker because we know you want that. Well, look, I agree with Michelle that science is sexier than conspiracy theories, but I don't think the public does. Right? There's 15% of the public that finds NASA interesting, and the others are somewhat indifferent or occasionally interested. So, you know, what do you think would sell more? Right, ancient aliens, where the aliens come to Earth and say, yeah, we're going to help those guys build these big pointy buildings in Egypt. Or, you know, okay, you know, this light here by the Schwarzschild limit radius of this black hole is going to refract way out. Okay, so I do think that the public represents a market for ideas, and they voted with their viewing dollars, their viewing time, to watch, you know, crud. I mean, that's been a lot of it, by the way. I gotta say, I think in almost every season of Ancient Aliens, and I think they're getting tired of me because I'm always skeptical. I think, you know, actually, I think that the people that built the entities that built the pyramids were Egyptians. They don't want to hear that. But so what's the lesson of all that? Having said that, what's the lesson? And I think the lesson is, do what America does great, and that's to co-opt crazy ideas, right? And just co-opt that. The ancient aliens, you know, real aliens, right? Something, but with the drama. I mean, why do people want to believe in UFOs, right? Why do they argue with me? Why is it so emotional? Even here in Boulder, I can tell you stories, but, you know, you're not adult enough for these stories. Okay, about Boulder's sort of being visited. And why do they find that so important? If I try and present facts to contradict them, they're not moved. It's because they know something important that those pointy-headed academics down there with their tweed jackets in all those red-tile buildings don't know. That's empowering. It's something. It's like a religion. You know, somebody says, "Ah, it's not right." Well, you're not going to say, "Oh, yeah, you're right, Bob." It's not going to happen. So I say co-opt. That's what I say.
I think it's been pretty apparent here, even in just listening to each of you speak in your own style of communicating science and about science communication. Enthusiasm is this great tool for science communication. You know, Bill Nye, the Mythbusters folks, all of them have put enthusiasm to great use to inspire understanding and discovery and awe. I'm wondering about
how might we use enthusiasm, and can we use enthusiasm, to talk about really difficult topics in science communication? You know, climate change or declining biodiversity, things that are, maybe more sobering.
Are we just going in the same order?
No, there's no order here. Yeah, well, I mean, so for us, I think, one of the most successful stuff with the climate change, and again, we have a long way to go, is emphasizing the people that do this. So climate change is honestly a pretty depressing topic to talk about. I mean, it is frightening. However, I mean, it is also very much solvable in the sense that humans can adapt. And, I mean, it's not the end of civilization. It's not the end of humanity. You know, people can actually successfully adapt to this if we work together. But one of the things I've been trying to emphasize are the people. So we had these, incredible people that are flying, aircraft over the poles. And they're doing laser altimetry. They're bouncing lasers off the poles. And these are not, truly ossified scientists in brick buildings. They're out in the field. They're flying dangerously about 1,500 feet over the glaciers. They invited me to go along because I'm one of the assistant directors. But there's so much turbulence because the air is flowing off the glacier that the plane's bouncing around. I'm like, hell no. I'm not doing that. So, there are these wonderful, enthusiastic people. And when someone says, climate scientists, and again, we talked about this monolithic them, it's actually, Andrea and Lisa, and they're fixing this old plane, they're flying over the glacier. A lot of my friends are in Antarctica, in the deep interior, places you can't get to unless you take snowcat trains for weeks, and they're studying the ice, and they're in the right place for a satellite to go overhead so they can calibrate the measurement. Doesn't sound a little sexy, but when you show these people on these snowcats in the middle of Antarctica, and you ask questions like, how do you go to the bathroom? It's the people for me, I think, that really is it's sort of helping with these controversial things, the enthusiasm of the individual people. I do not find scientists at all wooden and gray and ossified. I mean, they're very passionate, excited people. You don't work for NASA by accident. It's like, well, I was trying to be a waiter, but instead I end up working for NASA. We're people who made this decision a long time ago, and this is kind of a dream for us. I mean, for me, that's the best thing about working for NASA, is the people. You work with people that are really passionate. And you also take away largely the money. I mean, nobody at NASA is going to get rich. We're on government schedule salaries. We're comfortable. And I thank you for your support. I mean, your tax money is paying my salary. But, it's the people for me that helps sort of break through some of this controversial stuff and actually showing the enthusiasm of what they do.
There's actually an interesting overlap between enthusiasm and social awkwardness, it turns out. So, when I started looking at, what is an awkward person? If we try to dissect this animal that's the awkward person, delightful people. What are the components to it? And one of the three major components is what I call the sense of interest. And it's that enthusiasm that you're talking about. It's that, one of the things I say about awkward people that's so great is that whatever they love, they really, really love it. Like, probably too much for their own social good. Sometimes they love Star Wars too much, or they love Dungeons and Dragons, or the clarinet, or whatever else, right? Things that aren't necessarily socially cool, but they really get into it. There's a researcher at Oxford who had this interesting finding where he compared hundreds of college students and hundreds of professionals across disciplines to see who was more awkward. You can probably guess how this is going to go, right? And the most awkward people, twice as awkward as the average person, were the mathletes who competed in mathematics competitions. The second place, though, were the scientists. Yeah. Scientists were about 60% more awkward than the average person. So great, right? It's a great enthusiasm, but there's some tendencies for awkward people. One of the things that we do is we talk for too long about things that people have become disinterested in a long time ago.
Not at this panel.
Yeah, right. You've experienced that, right? And you're like, wow, this should have stopped 20 minutes ago. But we're still going. And so I think knowing some of those proclivities socially, actually, can be helpful to the scientists to say, well, I know I talk for too long. I know sometimes I tend to be too blunt. I know sometimes I speak in jargon that other people aren't interested in. And I think the beauty of social awkwardness is if you remind people that they're prone to these things, they self-correct. They actually know the contingency plan to do it the better way, but you have to remind them. And so that's why some of these training programs and so forth I think are so valuable.
All right. We've covered that one. Well, we've had a variety of questions come in, thinking about also the practice of being a science communicator. How many people here hope to do more science communication to your neighbors, your family, to someone formally? Yeah, great. Especially, I think we have a demographic that gives some retired folks a little time and some students a little vision on their career. So it's perfect for thinking about what you suggest for people wanting to move into more science communication. Let's maybe lean it towards the students who are in the crowd, thinking about their next steps there. And perhaps, for example, a tool or method that they should use or kind of those first steps jumping into more science communication.
Start by talking to your kids. I don't know. If you really want to get into science communication, first I would point out to you that it's not lucrative. It's only occasionally gratifying. And for the rest, it's kind of worthless. But I'll start with your kids. If you're serious about it, you want to talk to people other than your family. Right, and this may have benefits. I know that when I talked to my family about it, I had a lot less interaction with my family in the future. I registered that as a benefit. But if you're serious, I'll be serious for a moment because they told the first panel I was on here in Boulder years ago. I tend not to tell stories here, but I'll tell this story. It was about UFOs, and some guy stood up in the audience. I said this the other day, and he started to. Talking about how he had been abducted by six different species of aliens right here in Boulder. Okay, I don't know if many of you have that experience, but he did. And he was very serious about it. In fact, he came to dinner at my house as I got to talk to him. And the funny thing was, looking at his wife, you could tell he really had been abducted. Because that's all he talked about, right? So their whole life revolved around his abductions. Anyhow, what was the point? There was some point here. Yes, at this panel... I'm saying, I started making a little bit of fun of it. I'm saying, I just can't picture why aliens would come, 150 light years just to abduct you for these breeding experiments that wouldn't work and wouldn't be comfortable. And somebody in the audience said, "We're sick and tired of your jokes." So since then, I've tried to keep humor down. I'll give you one hit. If you want to learn to talk about such things, right, and a great venue for that is a service club, a Rotary Club, Lions, whatever, okay, because those people are coming in every week, right, they don't know what you're going to talk, they don't know what the speaker's going to be. They would much prefer that you talk about, how to improve their golf score, their income, or improve their sex lives or something, that you stand up and say, "I want to tell you about that black hole they found last week," right? You know more about it than they do because you learned something about it. And it's a great speaking gig because if you bomb, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter, right? You only get 20 minutes, 25 minutes. You can't use slides, right? So try that. That's a great way to learn how to do public speaking.
Yeah, I think what's been useful to me is to try to get good at something else that's totally unrelated. And the thing that I really enjoyed was studying comedians. And we're really lucky now that we have all these YouTube videos and documentaries that talk about the craft, right? And you learn that if you say something three times in a row, it magically becomes funny, even if it wasn't inherently funny and stuff. That's a good tool to have, right? It's a great comedian. They'll start with a story somewhere about a quarter or a third of the way through. They'll always end with a reference to that story at the end to tie the whole thing up. Now the audience feels this emotional connection that they're part of that story. Right? And as I got into it, I'm like, what a wealth of knowledge there is out there about getting nerdy about comedians in a lot of ways and how they conduct their craft. That's very different from science. And I just did that for a while. Now I watched tons of stand-up. I talked to a lot of comedians. In New York, I'm really lucky. I had a lot of comedians just there talking about their craft and how they think about it. I don't fashion myself as a comedian at all, but I learned so many valuable tools and specific tricks that then when I intersected those with some of the science communication stuff, it really gave some nice insights into how we might do this. And so I've used some of those same things. And if you read a chapter that I've written, you'll see I introduce something about a quarter of the way through, and always loop back to it at the end. And that's just a simple application of this other field's wisdom to something that I'm trying to do in science.
Yeah, giving people a real sense of learning about communication broadly writ.
Actually, I'll sort of say it a little bit quickly. Seth sort of mentioned this idea of failure, and failure not really mattering all that much. And this is one of the things we actually train scientists about for public talks. We have them do exercises with the improv artists that are basically failures designed in. There's no way you're going to be able to do this correctly. At some part, you're going to screw up. But the response is that the whole class cheers. You know, that when you've done this, and all of a sudden now you've flopped up, everyone goes, ta-da! You know, I mean, everyone cheers you because you failed. And everyone's laughing, and we do this over and over again. And they realize later, we're desensitizing them to the fact that if you fail, it's so damn bad. Rotary, we talked about Rotary Clubs. Now, I agree. So I speak at Rotary Clubs and at all kinds of civic organizations. And the last one I did, NASA has a new security policy for our computers. You can't even turn your computer on unless you have this special badge with a badge reader. And that was changed. It used to be you could actually turn your computer on without special badges. So the first thing, I grabbed my computer, went to the talk, turned my computer on, and brought my badge. So all of my slides, all my presentation, nope. And so what you do is all of a sudden you need to talk to people. You know, put the slides down. You know, back away from the PowerPoint. You know, this is a big thing for scientists. Do not do it. You show people the graph, and if people are not specifically trained in that specialty, they're going to get zero out of that. Absolutely nothing. It's going to go right over their head. Scientists will not believe me, because I know that sometimes a graph is the best way to communicate something, but only to a very specific audience. So, you know, the other thing that I really encourage you to remember is the humility of remembering that you didn't always know this material. It's a bad one for scientists. You know, this person could not remember that when he was in fourth grade, he didn't know about helioseismology, right? You know, I'm always amazed at, you know, both Seth and I do lecture tours, sometimes together with the Smithsonian or with some other groups, and these are people who have paid to be on these science-related tours. And, you know, I mean, they have a lot of money. The only reason we go is we could not afford it ourselves, right? We get free trips out of this. So it's great. But, you know, I'll be doing talks in Iceland about the Aurora Borealis, and we're talking about the chemistry of the atmosphere, and then someone will come up to me and say, you know, do you need to say the sun is the same thing as the stars? You know, and this is an educated, successful, in this case, businesswoman. And she had never understood that the sun was the same thing as the stars. The stars are just farther away. You need to really remember, you did not know this material. You know, scientists will assume you know what a galaxy is. Probably most people in the room here do, but I bet some people, if I ask some questions, you really don't understand what that is. The difference between a comet and an asteroid, they're totally different, right? What's the difference? So, you know, don't worry about failure so much. Get away from the PowerPoint, obviously the graphs, and remember that you didn't used to know what you even consider the most basic information.
Great. So we only have about 10 minutes left, and first I'm going to seed you. At the very end, I want from each of you a number one recommendation on a popular science book or magazine for non-scientists. So you can think about that. In the meantime, you address your thoughts on what is the next frontier for science communication. That's a pretty broad question. It could take in techniques, topics, or focus methods.
I don't know what the next frontier is, and it won't be the final frontier. But I don't know. You know, you get older, you get cynical a moment. So, and if you look at the fraction of the public that actually understands very basic science concepts, it hasn't changed very much. You know, all this effort, I get every month, you know, a couple of skeptics magazines. Anybody here, you know, remember the skeptics? No? Nobody's skeptical in Boulder. Well, and they have all these programs. They have a sort of an anti-religion bias, which I think probably hurts them. But they're also trying to combat pseudoscience, right? And that's a noble thing, and I think it's a good thing to do. But has it reduced the level of belief in pseudoscience? You're right. No, it hasn't. And all these people are still working at it. Now, of course, what you don't know is, well, what if they hadn't done all that work? Maybe it would have gotten worse. Maybe. But, you know, that's just an hypothesis, which we know can't possibly be true. So, it's I think that we haven't made a whole lot of progress here. So to say, what's the next frontier? I don't know, maybe just keep on. The real answer is to get to people early, of course, right? You got to get them even before probably middle school, a little bit of science, but certainly by middle school. Kids get interested in something between 8 and 11, and a lot of them would get interested in science if you made it a little more appealing. And the ways to do that, we've talked about them, but they're not cryptic. They're not hard to imagine what they are. This is a popular media for sure, a government program to put more emphasis on STEM. They talk a lot about STEM, but, you know, what's the difference in the schools? Do you see a difference? Otherwise, I think it'll probably stay the same level it is now. And that's fine. In the past, it was always fine. But it's maybe not going to be so fine in the future because now there's competition in the world. And some countries, and I don't need to name them, actually do a far better job of this than we do. So there's something to be worried about.
I think for social science, I hope the next frontier is getting our act together in-house. One of the problems we have is that we publish things, singular studies, and then it gets through the media, and it contradicts something that just happened 2 weeks ago, and it erodes the public's trust in science. Psychology is a great example. There's a replication crisis in psychology, and I'm glad there's attention being brought to this. But there are hundreds of findings in psychology that are well replicated and that are very reliable. And I think one of the things we need to do is come to some consensus about at what level of certainty do we need to be at before we strategically communicate things in a way that's helpful and useful. As it stands, not just in the social sciences, even in things like medicine, for things like diet, how often do you see that 1 week wine's good for you, the next week it's going to kill you, right? Next week, you know. And that erodes the public's trust in science. I think we have to assume that the media with the 24/7 news cycle will be reactive, will be sensational, and that's their job, and that's okay. But we need to be strategic then about how we disseminate information in that kind of environment.
I see the next frontier. I mean, let's put it bluntly. The practice of scientists is so damn privileged, right? I mean, the definition of privilege, basically, is to be a scientist. And it seems to be attracting sort of a narrow population, also narrow personality. I think that one of the things we need to get much better at is figuring out how to reach more diverse audiences, and that means talking to them and talking about what they need, what they're basically able to absorb. I know when we work with tribal colleges, Native American peoples, we found out that they, we tried to bring them as interns to NASA, but young people, even like in the late teenage years, usually had generations of people depending on them financially and for work. We couldn't take them out of the reservations very easily, so we went there. They weren't so much interested in being practicing scientists as they were in being documentary filmmakers. They really enjoyed that. So we set up documentary film studios in the tribal colleges and asked them the one thing that you should do is produce one video for us about how climate change is affecting your tribe. We got some really interesting stuff back. Some of it very well produced, some of it not, but that wasn't the goal. The goal was to get these people to feel that they had some part of what's going on. How are we going to reach out to different economic brackets, to different ethnicities? As a woman in science of a kind of an emotional, enthusiastic nature, I've been told so many damn times that I don't have the right personality to be a scientist. But, the universe doesn't care a crap about that, right? I mean, the universe doesn't care what age you are, what ethnicity you are, the shape of your body, how you emotionally experience versus logically experience. The cultural definition of how we practice science has really eliminated most of the population from feeling part of it. So I think for me, it's going to be, we failed so far to reach more diverse audiences. And how can we actually involve these people by going into their communities and finding out what they need?
I really like how that your comment on reaching diverse audience connects with Seth's on talking to people earlier on, really thinking about schools. The vast majority of our children are in schools, and that's potentially a really nice place to reach some of those audience. But it does mean not just talking to schools right and older or something like that, right? So going out and finding those kinds of spaces. All right, so I left you with a little thought question about a top-notch favorite popular science book, or as one questioner said, another option would be a
Scientific American for non-scientists. So what's kind of top on your reading list, both maybe as demonstrations of really excellent science communication and just an enjoyable read?
There's a site you can go to. It's an online magazine called Futurity. I don't know if I can spell that, but it's Futurity, and it's great. They take top findings that are well done and solid science, and they communicate in ways really interesting and really timely. So I'd suggest that, probably.
I have no suggestions, actually, because those are not books that I read, of course, so I don't know. But I'm just thinking back to my own youth, just after independence had been declared. I was motivated by things like Mr. Blizzard on TV. I mean, in the popular media, you go see all these cheesy sci-fi films, and they got me sort of interested in space, right? But in my case, it was more a matter of being interested in something and then just finding some materials. If you can just get the kids to go to the library, look up whatever they find interesting, I think that would work. And again, I think the magic age is 8 to 11, so pay attention to the kids that are in that age bracket. And just, I was fortunate, I had parents that stimulated whatever interest I had, they were willing to support that, right, up to a point, anyway. So.
I guess I'll recommend a book I just finished, actually. I really enjoyed it. It's called Einstein, His Life and His Universe. It's by Walter Isaacson. And that was it's a biography, right? But the author learned enough of the physics that as you go along with the story, you learn a lot of physics in a really, really engaging and interesting way. Einstein, of course, is far more complex than the myth of Einstein. I've done talks about how harmful this idea that Einstein was this isolated, single, brilliant person that pulled it out of the air, right? No. He wasn't part of the academic establishment. He didn't do well in school. Myth. Not true. And as Einstein was writing his theory of general relativity, there was actually another scientist called Hilbert that was right on his tail. And there are a lot of people in general relativity, including Kip Thorne, the famous black hole person, that believes that Hilbert was the one that actually first published the theory of general relativity. However, in the book, Einstein turned out to be even more brilliant than I knew. I didn't know about his contributions to thermodynamics and to some of the early, the idea of what a molecule is. And then amazingly, he was the person that came up with the idea, at least one of the first people who came up with the idea of quantum entanglement. And after he saw that, he backed away from pretty much all of what he was doing and never did a damn interesting thing for the last 40 years of his life. He could not handle the implications of what science was doing. So I get a lot of people sending me their theory that disproves Einstein, people who have no background in physics. I wrote my notebook. Somebody gave me a whole notebook yesterday of their theory, and they want me to read it and give it to Brian Greene. And it's not the way that science works, of course. There's no way I could possibly do that. And I sat there and listened to this person. I mean, that's what you do. You listen. You don't contradict them. You don't burst their bubble. I tried to balance his expectations of what I could do. But this idea that one person just comes out of this, I've gotten hundreds of these over the course of my career, and I want somebody to do some social research on this, because this is a weighty disproportion. Hundreds, and they're all from men. I've never had a woman come up to me with her theory that disproves Einstein and wants me to read it. It happens to me weekly. I think this is pretty interesting, actually.
I got to defend my sex here. It's true. I have a stack of these things too. And usually they just proved Einstein with fourth grade mathematics. And it is all men. But on the other hand, I had three regular correspondents who claimed they were aliens, and they were all women.
Well, I hope that this conversation has given you some ideas about science communication. Also now some new research ideas for anyone who wants to dive into those topics. And hope you've been inspired and look for ways to continue the science communication conversation outside of this room. For example, you can follow all of our panelists on Twitter and continue the conversation here at the University of Colorado. So thank you to all of you for attending, and let's give our finalists one final.